Hello, everyone, and welcome to the webinar. This is Mark Smith of IBM Watson Health. You've joined a webinar sponsored by the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, or IAP. It comes to you through the Children's Oral Health Initiative Value-Based Payment Project. Next slide. A few notes on logistics. All telephone lines will be muted. To participate in the polling question, you'll need to exit out of full screen mode. Once you've answered, you can go back into full screen mode if you wish. Finally, you can use the chat box on your screen to ask a question or leave a comment. Next slide. So we have three objectives today. We'll summarize the importance of payment reform in children's oral health. We'll describe Medicaid value-based payment, or VBP, approaches that states can use to improve children's oral health outcomes. And then we'll provide some examples of Medicaid VBP approaches that are being used in the field of children's oral health. Next slide. So in our agenda, we'll start with an overview of the Medicaid, IAP, and VBP webinar series. We'll then move on to the importance of payment reform in children's oral health. Then we'll talk about specific Medicaid VBP approaches in children's oral health, and that will include perspectives from the states of Oregon and Texas. And at the end, we'll have a list of resources. Next slide. We have quite a few presenters today from IBM Watson Health, from CMS, and from Oregon and Texas. And three of the speakers from Texas will be from MCNA Dental and DentaQuest. Next slide. Now I'll turn it over to Catherine Griffith of CMS.
Hi, thank you, Mark. Welcome, everyone. I'm Catherine Griffith. I'm a senior advisor for the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program here at CMS. Just want to welcome everybody here. We are so pleased to have everybody on the second webinar in the IAP Value-Based Payment Webinar Series. And just a quick background, we, on the next slide about Medicaid, the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, many of you probably know we are a CMMI model that's based in CMCS, so we work very closely with CMMI to provide technical assistance to state Medicaid programs around delivery system reforms. And so we're really focused on providing both one-on-one as well as national dissemination webinars such as this, technical assistance to states with topics around delivery system reform that range from things like substance use disorders, but also value-based payments and data analytics. And I always like to note that we're not a grant program. We are just purely focused on technical assistance. The next slide, again, just reviews that this is a series the Innovation Accelerator Program is putting on around value-based payments. Our first webinar was a few weeks ago on considerations of Medicaid value-based payments. Those slides and materials will be posted shortly on the Medicaid.gov IAP website. So you'll be able to find those, as well as these slides shortly after a few weeks after this webinar also. And then in the next few weeks, please look out for the next two on substance use disorders and maternal and infant health. So again, happy to have everybody here, and I'll pass it back to Mark.
Thank you. Next slide, please. We're going to start with a poll. So remember, you'll need to exit out of full screen mode. So this question has to do with how familiar you are with VBP. Choice one is, I am well-versed in VBP approaches. Number two is, I'm aware of them but don't consider myself an expert. Number three is, I'm new to value-based payment. And four is, I have only participated in the introductory webinar on October 5th called Medicaid IAP VBP Approaches and Key Design Considerations. You can select more than one option. So we'll give you about another 10 seconds to respond. Okay. Thank you. Let's close the poll. I see people are continuing to respond, but okay, so about just over half of people are aware of it but not an expert, and about a third say they're new to it, and that represents 90% of the people who responded. All right. Thank you very much. So I want to talk about what is tooth decay in children, right? We're thinking both of dental caries, the illness that causes cavities, and the cavities themselves. They are extremely common, unfortunately, 5 times more common than asthma, and it comes from preventable causes like poor diet and lack of access to preventive care. Tooth repair, of course, is valuable because it relieves symptoms and restores function, but it itself does not stop dental caries. Next slide. We find significant disparities by race and ethnicity and by income in the prevalence of untreated tooth decay in children. So on the left side, we see figures by race and ethnicity. Among children 5 to 9, among white children, 15% had untreated tooth decay in 2011 and 2012, but it was 24 to 25% for black and Hispanic children. Among younger children ages 2 to 5 in 2014, there was a 41% rate of untreated tooth decay among American Indian and Alaska Native children. And we see fairly similar statistics on the right by household income. Those who are under 100% of the federal poverty level, this is children ages 5 to 9, 25% had untreated tooth decay in 2011-2012. The figure was a little lower for those up to 200% of the poverty level, and then in the 2 to 400%, you see a substantial drop down to 15%. Next slide. So this graphic illustrates the famous triple aim, but as it's applied to children's oral health. So the three elements are population health, the cost, and the patient experience. And these are carefully related, closely related. So, for example, if you have population, let's say you have children who are not getting adequate care, so that would be, and they have a higher incidence of dental caries and maybe need more significant dental work, so that's poorer population health on the top. Of course, moving down to the lower right, that's going to cost more. And probably, moving over to the left, they're going to have a worse experience because they need to have more visits and spend more time and may have experienced some pain if they have major work done. That's just one example of how these fit together. Next slide. When you think about how dental care is reimbursed in this country, most of it's based on a fee-for-service reimbursement system, and then you might delineate 4 levels of treatment. So on the far left, we have the least expensive thing, preventive care, such as cleanings, topical fluoride, and sealants. And also relatively inexpensive are diagnostic procedures like x-rays and intraoral occlusal films. And moving to the right, basic reparative care like fillings and extractions. These are somewhat more expensive, and the most expensive are major procedures like crowns, bridges, and root canals. Naturally, if we're going to reduce the inflation in spending, that's the reduce the rate of growth in spending on dental care, we need to move as much care as we can to the left side of this. Next slide. Now we'll talk about some value-based payment approaches that are possible in children's oral health under the Medicaid program. Next slide. This alternative payment model framework illustrates 4 categories of the relationship between payment and value and quality. So on the far left, in category 1, we have traditional fee-for-service where there's no link of quality to payment. In category 2, we have the beginning elements of linking them. So you may have pay for reporting or pay for performance. In many areas of medicine, these have been going on for 10 or 20 years or more. In category 3, you get into alternative payment models, or APMs, that are built on a fee-for-service architecture. So, for example, under B, you see upside and downside risk. An example of this would be a program in which there's a threshold for a certain group of patients, and it's a dollar threshold for all of their care for the year. And if the provider, on average, stays below that threshold by a certain amount, the provider gets some shared savings. But conversely, if the provider's average is too far above that threshold, then there's a loss, a penalty. Over in Category 4, you get full population-based or capitated payments. And what you also find in Category 4 is integration, not only dental care providers integrated with one another in networks, but then also integrated with non-dental providers. Next slide, please. So here are some key elements that one has to think about when designing a value-based payment program. Things like what group of patients will it focus on? If it's an approach that's limited to certain services, like a bundled payment or episode-based payment, you have to decide which services are included. And then how you are going to measure payment, this is financial performance, and quality, both what measures will you use and what benchmarks will you start with to use as thresholds for judging against future events. And you also need to think about how to attribute patients to providers, given that many patients see multiple providers in the same year. As I mentioned in the last slide, there's risk adjustment when you get into certain kinds of models so that providers are not averse to treating patients with the highest morbidity. And finally, behind all of this, there's typically a lot of data sharing decisions that have to be made so that individual providers can share data with a centralized group. Next slide. And we can think about those in the context of this crystal ball graphic from the American Dental Association. In the lower left, thinking back to the APM slide from two slides ago, in the lower left, you have the solo practice, and along the x-axis, you have the size of the practice, and along the y-axis, the level of integration. So the lower is like APM category one. It's traditional fee-for-service, solo practice, mostly it's a surgical focus. This is a focus on fixing things. And then what you want to do is be moving up the blue arrow to the right. So as you move up, you get to dental practices rather than solos, and with a prevention focus, and if you keep going, you get to dental ACOs. This is accountable care organizations. Often these are carve-out arrangements in insurance. You have those have regional dental networks typically, and because it's a carve-out, typically there is financial risk, both upside and downside, so these are alternative payment models. And then finally, as you get furthest up to the right, you get full integration of dental providers with one another and with non-dental providers and global payment. Okay, next slide, please. This slide presents the same kind of information in a tabular form so that as you go from tier one to tier four, it's like going to the up and to the right on the crystal ball slide along that blue arrow. So level one, fee-for-service with a surgical focus, no integration. Level two, fee-for-service with a prevention focus, maybe larger groups. You might have patient-centered medical homes, dental homes, and at least some amount of integration, such as facilitated referrals from non-oral care providers. When you get down to tier three, you're into alternative payment models. So you may have a dental health carve-out. Typically, there are large regional networks of dentists and some amount of shared financing. But still, there's a separate delivery system from non-oral healthcare. And finally, tier four is like the upper right in the crystal ball. You have shared financing, full integration with the non-oral healthcare system, and healthcare ACOs, large, fully integrated dental delivery organizations. Next slide. So what are some steps you can take to move yourself either down the tiers, one, two, three, four, or up to the right along that blue arrow? Engaging providers is tremendously important. That's been found time and time again in all sorts of areas of healthcare. Engaging both clinical champions and sort of frontline providers. Second, you need to develop or coordinated payment and care delivery systems. You need to choose quality measures and It says here, use appropriate data architecture and elements. This is, you could say more generally, you need to take account of your IT system, what it's capable of doing. You might decide in the long run to get a different one that is more capable, maybe, maybe not, but you need to, as you're choosing quality measures and implementing this, you need to think about what is really feasible in terms of data and IT. And finally, improving coordination between oral and medical health. Next slide. Okay, now we have another poll question. So what challenges do you face with your current dental payment model? And again, keep in mind, you can give more than one answer. So one is lack of access to oral health and or dental providers, so too few providers. The second one is suboptimal use of services, such as too much reliance on emergency care versus preventive care. The third is a lack of implementation of evidence-based care. Fourth is a lack of integration or coordination between dental and medical providers. And fifth would be other. I'll hold the poll open for about another 10 seconds. Okay, why don't we close the poll? The answers are slowing down. About 90 have responded. And integration is clearly number one. Two-thirds of the respondents chose integration or coordination, or really the lack thereof. Almost half chose lack of access to oral health care or dental providers. And almost half chose suboptimal use of services. And 3/8 shows evidence-based practices or lack of implementation of those. All right. Thank you. Next slide, please. Okay, so now we have a chance for you to ask questions. If you put them in, you need to put them in the box. There's a Q&A. And I should say that if you wanted, you could use the chat as a way to talk about other things. You may, the fifth option from the poll question was other, and about 14% of the respondents chose it. You could use that as a way to talk about what the other was, if you wish. Okay, so right now we have no questions. So since we started late, why don't we continue on? Excuse me. Now we're going to hear state perspectives from Oregon and from Texas. And they're going to make a presentation, and then I'm going to ask them a couple of questions. Next slide. Our first speakers from Oregon will be Amanda Peden and Sarah Kleinschmidt. Amanda and Sarah, are you ready?
Yes, thank you. So this is Amanda Peden from the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm a policy analyst with Oregon. I'd like to start by giving an overview of Oregon's coordinated care model, which forms the basis for our performance incentive program, which Sarah will speak about in more detail in a moment. Next slide, please. Thank you. Oregon's Medicaid program, the Oregon Health Plan, primarily uses a network of managed care health plans, which we call Coordinated Care Organizations, or CCOs, and these provide integrated coordinated care to members. CCOs are networks of all types of healthcare providers, physical health providers, addictions and mental health, and dental care providers, who work together to serve Oregon Health Plan, our Medicaid program members, through implementing this coordinated care model. And this slide shows really a graphic of the key components of that coordinated care model. The essential components include best practices, or otherwise evidence-based practices, to manage and coordinate care, transparency in price and quality, which helps to ensure accountability of the system and helps patients understand their plan and make choices about their care, shared responsibility for health, the idea that providers, payers, and consumers need to work together to improve health. Performance measurement is another key part of the model, including the importance of aligning under common measurement strategies and common goals to ease provider burden, sustainable rate of growth, or bending the cost curve, which is a really vital component of this coordinated care model, and one that strengthens all of the other principles. And for example, in Oregon's Medicaid program, we aim to keep our cost increases at or below 3.4%. And finally, pay for outcomes and health, or value-based payment, which is the most relevant for today's conversation. This element of the model is illustrated in a global budget for our CCOs and also a set of performance incentive metrics designed to improve quality. Next slide. While a coordinated care model can apply to any type of payer, the primary way that Oregon has implemented the coordinated care model so far is through our coordinated care organizations, or CCOs. And this slide provides a high-level overview of the CCOs. Currently, we have 16 coordinated care organizations, and they function similarly to accountable care organizations, or ACOs. CCOs are responsible for physical, mental, and dental care, all managed under one global budget. Oregon health policymakers see the integration of oral, behavioral, and physical health care as central to the goal of providing whole-person coordinated care and promoting health equity. Oral health in particular was incorporated somewhat later than behavioral health into the model, but has been in the global budget since 2014. CCOs hold broad responsibility for the oral health needs for members of all ages in Oregon. So Oregon is one of about 15 states that offers comprehensive dental benefits to children and to adults, including members of the Medicaid expansion population. So part of the reason why it's so important to integrate dental into CCOs. A significant goal for Oregon under the coordinated care model has been to move away from fee-for-service payment models. So CCOs, as I mentioned, operate under a global budget, which provides them additional flexibility in meeting member needs. Additionally, CCOs can earn extra quality incentive payments when they meet certain metrics, which is something we wanted to focus on particularly today. And finally, CCOs are encouraged to use alternative payment models when reimbursing providers directly. While the CCOs all operate under the coordinated care model and work toward common goals, they're also designed as community-based entities with flexibility to serve the needs of their communities. They identify these needs primarily through community health assessments and community advisory councils, which contain both Medicaid members and other community partners. Oregon also assists with innovation and quality improvement for the CCOs through a state office at the Oregon Health Authority called the Transformation Center, and also regular quality meetings with the CCOs. And then one of the major tools to drive quality is a pay-for-performance program called the Performance Incentive Metrics Program. And I'll now hand it over to Sarah to provide more detail on this program. Next slide, please.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sarah Kleinschmidt, and I work at the Oregon Health Authority's Incentive Measures Program. So in terms of that program, I want to give you a bit more detail about it. A portion of our coordinated care organization global budget, 4.25% to be exact, is set up as pay for performance. CCOs can receive bonus payments from this quality pool to improve quality on a set of metrics, and currently there are 17 measures. CCOs qualify by reaching or achieving progress towards a set of targets on each metric. In terms of the dollars on the line, and to put this in perspective, in 2016, this 4.25% equated to just under $179 million, and that was spread across our 16 CCOs. So that's a lot of money on the line. Two of the 17 measures included in the program are focused on oral health. The first looks at children between the ages of 6 and 14 who receive a sealant on a permanent molar, and the second looks at whether children in foster care have received physical, mental, and dental health assessments. So why did we choose these two oral health-based measures in particular? Well, for the sealant measure, it was very well vetted and tested measure by the Dental Quality Alliance. And we also have a really robust program of dental sealants in school-based systems in schools in our state, and we wanted to expand and connect that to our coordinated care organizations. In terms of the foster care measure, this measure was already in existence, looking at physical and mental health assessments. And so we really thought that this would be a great way to build on that measure to incentivize the integration of oral health. Next slide, please. So this slide, I'll get into performance now. This slide talks about the shows how we performed on the dental sealants measure. I want to call out that we use standardized national measures where possible, but we do make changes as needed. So, for example, this measure, it's based on the Dental Quality Alliance measure, but the Dental Quality Alliance focuses specifically on children who are at elevated caries risk. But risk coding in our state is not as extensive, and it's not used uniformly in our state. So if we did that, we would have been eliminating a lot of children in our Medicaid program. So we don't make that exclusion. We look at all children between these ages in the state. So just thinking about our incentive program and how we choose the measures, and sometimes we do have to change them from national standards. In terms of performance, though, the proportion of children between 6 and 14 that you see here, so that's both age ranges, who received a dental sealant on a permanent molar in the past year has increased from 2014. And actually, statewide performance surpassed our aspirational target or benchmark in 2016. So you can see on the slide there on the right-hand side in darker blue where it says 2016, that gray line there shows the benchmark of 20%. And statewide performance actually got up to 21.5%, so we have since increased that benchmark. Next slide, please. And I'll talk briefly about this as well. So this measure, our assessment of children in DHS custody or children in foster care, this is really a success story for us. You can see here that performance has really, really increased, and that's across these 2 years, and that equates to 168% improvement in just 2 years. The other thing I will note on this, though, is that it addresses a different aspect of oral health. So the first measure looks at dental sealants, and this looks at dental health assessments. So those are our two oral health measures included in our quality incentive program.
Next slide. And this is just our contact information, and we are available for additional questions and happy to share more about Oregon's model.
Thank you, Amanda and Sarah. We'll come back to questions in a little while after Texas presents. Now we turn to Texas Medicaid and CHIP efforts, and we'll have Matthew Ferrara of the Texas Health and Human Services Commission, Shannon Turner of MCMA Dental, and Rebecca Matthews and James Burns from DentaQuest. Matthew, are you ready?
Yes. Hello, everybody. This is Matt Ferrara with the Texas HA. So I wanted to talk about two programs that we have in the Medicaid CHIP programs related to advancing quality and value-based purchasing. The first is our dental pay-for-quality program. This is a program where we have a certain percentage of each DMO's capitation at risk, some 1.5%. We're focused on four measures. We're looking at the four measures being the DQA oral evaluation, the DQA topical fluoride, the DQA sealants for 6 to 9-year-olds, and the DQA sealants for 10 to 14-year-olds. We're looking at those measures comprising our pay-for-quality program. Again, we have 1.5% of the capitation at risk. We're looking at focusing on improvement on those measures. So basically, this program is a redistributive model. So a DMO could lose up to 1.5% of their capitation based on whether or not they're worsening in performance across these measures. We're looking at our first period of measurement for this particular program being calendar year 2018. Calendar year 2016 will be our baseline period where we'll reference if a DMO should worsen in performance. And we look at performance for each metric. A certain percentage of capitation is attached to each metric. We look across the Medicaid and CHIP programs. If there's a net decline, a net loss in capitation across all those metrics across the programs, those dollars are available for the other DMO to claim if they should have a net positive across the measures across the programs. And so we're really looking at trying to drive improvement through a competitive model that redistributes dollars from one DMO to another. If there are both DMOs improve in performance, then there's no dollars to be redistributed. If they both decline in performance, there's no dollars to be redistributed. So you have to have one that does better or has a net positive for them to avail themselves of the recoup dollars. The second program that we have, it's in our contract, is we're trying to stimulate more value-based contracting, both with our MCOs and in our standalone DMOs. And we put some performance targets in contract for the percentage of dollars that are paid to providers that should be governed by a value-based purchasing construct. And for the DMOs, we've established an overall target of 25% of provider payments to be governed by a value-based purchasing construct. And then of that 25%, we have a subset of that being 2% of the dollars in an at-risk model. And so we're trying to push this forward. We're using that land framework that was referenced earlier in the slide deck as our framework for both our managed care organizations and our DMOs. And we're looking at trying to advance that over a period of 4 years to 50% overall value-based purchasing target and a 10% at-risk purchasing target. And so those are pretty, I think, lofty goals. We'll see how we do. This is our first, 2018 will be our first year of establishing the targets, so we'll have to see what shakes out here. We do have an exception for meeting that target if a DMO should not experience any recoupments under the pay-for-quality program, that program where the capitation is at risk. If they don't have any recoupments under that program and they miss their target, we'll waive any sort of penalties associated with not fulfilling the target. So those are the two programs that we have in place for 2018. To try to stimulate this kind of activity. And I believe then we'll turn it over to one of the DMOs, I think MCNA, to talk about their program.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Matthew. This is Shannon Turner with MCNA. And I just want to briefly talk about our program that we have had going for several years now. It's the Stellar Treatment and Recognition Rewards Program. Next slide. Our program is a VBP approach that's really based on a P4P, P4Q model, pay-for-performance, pay-for-quality model. And it utilizes a fee-for-service payment with a bonus amount based on performance. Qualifying main dental home and primary care providers receive a bonus for providing timely preventive care. So what we do is Texas actually has a very robust main dental home program where not only are members assigned to a dental home provider, but payment is only available to that dental home provider. And this is very different than the other dental home programs that you see in Medicaid programs in other states, because in those states, even though you're assigned and encouraged to see one provider, if you were to go to another provider, that provider would be compensated. In Texas, only the primary care provider that is your assigned main dental home is compensated through the structure that they've outlined. So this has really lent itself to a robust pay-for-quality, pay-for-performance model. We look at five main areas for awarding points to participating main dental home providers: exams and recall visits, fluoride, sealants, first dental home visits, and pro fees. On sealants, we also do a modified version of the DQA measure in that we do exclude from the calculation from the denominator children who don't have any teeth eligible to be sealed based on the periodicity associated with sealants. So if you had sealants last year, obviously, you're not eligible for them this year, and you would be removed from the denominator. First dental home is a construct that's also unique to Texas. It's billed as the D0145 CDT code, and it's examinations for children under 3 years of age. In Texas, that's already actually a bundled payment
which is, you know, lends itself very well to VBP. And it's a bundled payment that includes fluoride application, pro-free exam, oral hygiene instructions, and anticipatory guidance to the caregiver. And it's really a great program in terms of getting kids off to a great start. Next slide. Providers have to treat at least 150 MCNA members in their practice during the measurement year to qualify. And that's how we utilize the program to encourage open panels by having a qualifying number of members treated. And the services we selected are key preventive services. So by making sure that your assigned members get in for the five services that we measure, we're really focused on making sure prevention is the focus. Unlike other bonus programs, we score in a tiered fashion based on the number of assigned patients receiving the targeted services. So it's not just an add-on payment, for example, if someone gets a sealant. It really is a tiered program where we look at all of the members assigned to you and the rate of success you have with getting your entire book of assigned members in for the targeted preventive care services. And bonuses are not based purely on service volume, but again, on their member panel compliance with recommended services and periodicity protocols. And we believe that looking at this holistically rather than patient by patient is very useful because we want to see providers who, you know, if you do have a large number of patients assigned to you, that they're all receiving their care in accordance with the AAPD periodicity schedule. Next slide. This is just one of the measures to show the preventive dental visit growth in terms of their outcomes data. These are the initial program years, and if you look at, and these are calendar years, and these are the validated results by the state's EQRO. You can see we started in 2013, then we saw very limited movement in 2014 after the first year of the program, and then we saw more of an uptick in 2015. And so what we've seen are more people getting that preventive dental visit. And overall, our rates have been very high for Medicaid programs, in that you can see our 2015 results, about 75% of all members assigned to MCNA, and it's roughly 1.5 million, had a preventive dental visit, and 74% in the CHIP population had a preventive dental visit. And that ends my presentation, and DentaQuest is now going to present.
Thank you, Shannon. This is Jim Burns from DentaQuest. Good afternoon, everyone. Next slide, please. When we started with the Pay for Quality program with Texas Medicaid and CHIP, we've been starting that since 2013 and forward, and we've seen considerable increases in our quality metrics performance. We attribute this to primarily closely aligning the provider incentive to these P4Q measures and having quarterly payments to them for this incentive and communicating to them about their performance in a scorecard. Currently, the VBP arrangement, as Shannon had said and Matt had said, with Texas is a fee-for-service preventative focus with an incentive with a dental home for each member. Next slide. Further, we're seeing a smaller year-over-year increase in restorative services 3 years into the P4Q program compared to considerably larger increases in preventative and diagnostic services. Long-term, we believe we are turning this into a trend, and this will help us achieve the oral health triple aim. Rebecca?
Thanks, Jim. Next slide, please. As DentaQuest has worked in assessing our approach to value-based reimbursement, we quickly adopted the LAN APM framework and used its quantitative assessment specifications to define and measure our status. We see that within the pay-for-performance or pay-for-quality program and other reimbursement arrangements in place within the state, We have healthy experience already in categories 2 and 3 within the dental program. The pay for quality or pay for performance program is within category 2 with fee for service reimbursement joined by that linkage to quality. And then, as Shannon mentioned, within the state, payment approach for the First Dental Home Initiative is combines a visit, payment for a visit for a series of services to be completed for a new patient evaluation within the CDT code for an early childhood oral evaluation, making a bundled payment arrangement and qualifying within Category 3 of the framework. Next slide. So looking ahead, and Matt alluded to this as well, HHSC has adopted specific goals to promote value and quality within its programs. Its specific focus on value-based purchasing is to increase focus on alternative payment models and introducing risk-based population models for the dental program next year. As shown in my prior slide, DentaQuest will be introducing a capitation program within our program in Texas in 2018. The goals of this program are to align with HHSC's overall focus on alternative payment model growth, and also to leverage the success in focusing on quality within the current Pay for Quality Incentive Program, allow our provider partners to serve as care managers for their assigned members, support the importance of prevention, and individualized care as key components of a value-based approach. In closing, pay for quality has been an important step in Texas's evolution to a value-based system. By allowing all partners to focus on shared savings, shared goals of improved access and prevention, and then also to give providers recognition for their successful efforts through incentive payments. Next slide. And here, contact information for the Texas presenters.
Thank you very much to all of you. And I want to let everyone know that we will send out the slides, including the ones that were inadvertently omitted, in a week or two, along with other materials. So now we have a few minutes in which I'll ask the speakers a question or two, and then we'll move to a time where the audience can submit questions. In fact, I see that some of you have already been submitting questions. The rest of you are also welcome to submit them even now. So I have the same question for both Oregon and Texas, which is, what are some challenges that you faced in implementing your model that you think might be instructive for other states that are considering a similar model? Why don't we start with Oregon?
So I'll talk, this is Sarah, and I'll talk specifically about the incentive program. But one challenge we've encountered is that the dental quality measurement field is still really emergent. So there are limited national measures with clear benchmarks for states to adopt. So for example, the two measures that we showed to you, we crafted and had to work and identify those benchmarks ourselves, but having some national standard would be exceedingly helpful. We've looked to the Dental Quality Alliance for measures, but in some cases we are looking to adopt our own specifically for Oregon. So again, that's the foster care assessments is one where we have done that. Benchmarking is a challenge. And so those, in terms of the incentive measure program, those are two of the things that we have found difficult in terms of trying to integrate oral health measures there.
And just at this is Amanda Peden, just at a broader level in terms of integration overall of oral health into our CCO model, I just mentioned that something that I think has been a challenge and also progress for us over the years is really figuring out how to work constructively to move from what was formerly a managed care system with a physical health managed care organization, a mental health managed care organization, and a dental health managed care organization into this integrated model. And with dental in particular, we have a very robust system of managed care dental care organizations that with the CCOs, we really integrated, wanted to integrate that system into CCOs. because it's such a strong system already that had been operating for many years, we needed to figure out how to bring those stakeholders together and also you know, do a lot of education, which I think has been happening and continues to happen both at the state level and on the ground, to really integrate oral health into that, what is the CCOs, what is a lot of expertise in the physical health model. And so that is something that we continue to work towards in Oregon, is that really full integration, and something that some of the measures that, such as the oral health assessments for foster care that Sarah mentioned, really help us to do in terms of a quality improvement strategy.
Okay, thanks. So, Matt, do you have an answer to this question? What are challenges you face? Go ahead.
Oh, yes. So when we talk about the pay for quality program, where we have the dental managed care organizations, the percentage of capitation at risk, we have two contracted DMOs, and that does present a challenge when you have a model that is really kind of set up where designed to for contractors to compete for performance and for others capitation dollars. When you have two, it kind of limits you to some degree. So that presents a challenge. And I think at the next level, where we have in the contract these contractual targets for value-based contracting, I think we're trying to stimulate activity in the risk-based contracting between DMOs and dental practices. But given that they're standalone DMOs, that I think that does present somewhat of a challenge in terms of you know, how they're going to enter into contracts, perhaps like capitation with a dental practice. So it remains to be seen how much of a challenge that is, but I think that having them as standalone DMOs presents a little bit of a challenge in that front.
I'm going to follow up with a question that came from a member of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Do the Texas MCOs have contracts with their own DMOs? And if so, are they required to include the at-risk contract arrangement?
So we have under contract, we have 20 medical MCOs, and dental is managed by the two contracted DMOs, not a separate contract from the medical MCOs.
Okay. A question that I think could be for either group, either state. Somebody asks, why provide a bonus for prophylaxis when there's no evidence of effectiveness for children? Maybe the question is, do you feel that there is evidence of effectiveness for prophylaxis in young children?
Actually, we do believe that there is evidence of effectiveness, and it's one of the measures that the dentists who helped create the program feel very strongly about. And again, when we're looking at that and we're looking at it being coupled with anticipatory guidance for the caregiver, it has shown in Texas under the First Dental Home Initiative Program that it's been very effective. And the University of Texas at San Antonio College of Dentistry has evidence showing that prior to the program being implemented, there were more hospital cases, there were more issues that they saw with very young children, and once the prophy, anticipatory guidance, and fluoride were all tied into those very young exams, they saw a difference in siblings who, in the same family, prior to the program, an older sibling may have had to have a full mouth rehab in a hospital setting, versus after implementation of the program, you weren't seeing that with the additional children that came into the family.
Okay. Now we have two questions.
I've also heard that the – oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say it's also encouraged by the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry and is one of the key aspects of the periodicity schedule.
Okay. Here's one question about risk assessment and another which I think concerns that also. One person asks, how is risk assessment being used to drive appropriateness of care or increased frequency of targeted services for higher risk patients? And another person, this probably gets to the financial aspect, but also concerns risk. Do you weight the member panel for each provider? So why don't we go back to Oregon? This is about risk assessment methods and how that relates to appropriateness of care.
So in terms of the measures that we're using, that's what I was trying to address earlier. So the Dental Quality Alliance measure does include risk assessments, but it's an area that in our state risk assessments are not used uniformly or extensively throughout the state. So from that the measurement perspective, it would have been very limiting for us to include that in the measures. Do you want me to answer the second question as well?
Sure. Go ahead.
And can you repeat it, please?
Sorry, do you weight the member panel for each provider?
Okay, yeah. So for us, that would be different because our measures are at the coordinated care organization level, which you can think of more as the plan level.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question. I'll go back to Texas. Do you know or how would you characterize the distribution of dental practices along that tier spectrum from 1 through 4, or you might think of the blue arrow from the lower left to the upper right?
This is Rebecca Matthews. I'll speak to that. I think we still see a heavy volume that are, you know, definitely fee-for-service and a lot of experience due to HHSC's pay-for-performance program in that second category. But there's a mix in terms of the provider practice approach between individual practices and more larger organizations that have numerous service locations. So I think we're still at the, you know, lower end of the trajectory. But to me, it's looking at how the model of care and the financing mechanisms move ahead to inform and to also complement how practice patterns are emerging as well.
Thank you. Here's a question for Oregon. How were foster care children identified? And if you did identify them, does that include all of them, just those in foster care, others, child welfare, and so on, for the sake of setting measures and performance expectations?
So the Oregon Health Authority works very closely with the Department of Human Services, which manages child welfare, and they have a reporting system, and so we work with them very closely to be able to identify the children who are in foster care. And then we those reports to calculate our denominator.
And was that the measure that pertained to that, was that one that it's state-specific, or is it something, a national measure that Oregon adopted?
It is state-specific.
So Oregon has a state requirement that foster care youth gets these oral health, physical health, and mental health assessments, and so it's specific to our state that we're trying to incentivize that and make sure it's happening among the CCOs.
Okay, last question. This is for Texas. By linking payment to a dental home, how do you address families who are constantly moving or homeless?
This is Shannon Turner. When Texas structured the program, they looked at families that are constantly moving and homeless in that it's very simple for you to change your dental home. So as a member, you're not locked in to a dental home at any point in time, but you do have to affirmatively change it. And you can do that by contacting customer service. Your provider is aware of the need for a dental home, and they can help you facilitate that switch. And we have seen a great deal of success with that. Members move, they're able to switch their dental home, and the utilization that you see in Texas on both the DQA and CMS 416 measures really show the benefits of the program, as Texas, I believe, has been one of the top two plans for several years running since implementation of the Maine Dental Home Program.
All right, thank you. Now let's move on to the next slide, please. I just want to offer a brief summary. So as we've seen, implementing payment reform in state Medicaid agencies can influence the health outcomes in children's oral health, and state Medicaid agencies like Oregon and Texas and others have begun to successfully implement value-based payment approaches. It does require a significant amount of engagement and coordination efforts, as we've heard, value-based payment really stands to improve population oral health and improve patient experience and reduce costs. Next slide, please. I just want to end with some resources that you can find, and in addition to these that are listed, as I said, we will be sending out materials from the webinar in a couple of weeks. And next slide, please. We've come to the end of our time. I want to thank you for joining today's webinar. We hope to see you at the following Medicaid IAP value-based payment webinars. On the 26th of October, there's one on approaches for substance use disorders, and on November 2nd, approaches to maternal and infant health. Finally, we ask you to take a moment and complete a short feedback survey. Thank you very much.